This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Hello, and welcome back to WrestleSpective. I'm your host, Jason Mann, and joining me again to continue our annual WrestleMania tradition is Sawyer Paul. Sawyer, thank you for coming back.
Thank you for having me.
You excited to, this is a big one. This is WrestleMania 30. We're going to talk about both of Daniel Bryan's matches at WrestleMania 30, the opener against Triple H, and to earn the title shot in the main event against Randy Orton and Batista. Went through 3/4 of Evolution, which isn't too bad.
When you did WrestleMania 10, mm-hmm. I wonder, did you also talk about Bret and Owen?
I don't think we did, no.
So this is a... So this is a new thing where you talk about an undercard match instead of a main event.
I guess so. Yeah.
All right.
We're changing some rules here. We're not afraid to, you know, I did that podcast probably 4 years ago. So
sure.
I think it's reasonable that we change our things. I also think that this is.
It's all kind of one long match too.
Yeah. And this is also like, this is a little bit more direct. Like, Bret wrestled that match for personal pride and wrestled that match because it was a suitable opponent since Lex Luger, you know, was wrestling Yokozuna first. But he didn't have to win that match. In fact, he didn't win that match to face off in the main event. So I consider it slightly different, even though it is that story is quite similar to what Daniel Bryan is doing here in some respects.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a bit like, there's also obviously the parallels of WrestleMania 20, and even 10 as well. You know, both Bret Hart and Chris Benoit had sort of an overwhelming movement of fan support, not as vocal as what, you know, went with Daniel Bryan, but certainly they were chosen over guys who looked the part more. Bret Hart being chosen instead of Lex Luger, Chris Benoit being chosen, you know, I'd say against the usual Triple H and Shawn Michaels club. I'm not sure who would have been his competitor there, but it's kind of the same idea as this fan movement. A more organically popular wrestler is chosen over a more manufacturedly popular wrestler.
Well, it goes back farther than that. Famously, WrestleMania 0 and WrestleMania 10 also had the same thing going on. Or WrestleMania minus 10 also had the same thing going
WrestleMania
on.
WrestleMania minus 10.
That's right. They do it every 10 years.
Okay.
They've been doing it ever since WrestleMania minus 40.
Oh, wow. That's a long time ago.
Very cold.
Who made event of that?
I didn't think that far into the bit.
Was it like Kodiak Jack or something? You know?
Yes, absolutely.
The Eskimo. I mean, you obviously being Canadian, you're familiar with the cold, so I would imagine you would be, you know, familiar with the cold weather wrestlers. that's my Canadian. That's my stereotypes of, you know, people from your land.
Well, it was supposed to be Glacier, but fan support, you know, got the other guy.
Yeah, that's fair. I would imagine that if only WCW had been based in Nova Scotia, I think that Glacier would have taken off much more.
Things would have been very different for Glacier.
Yes. So, I mean, there's a lot of interesting stuff here. I mean, there's a whole lot of stuff kind of in this story of, like, there's a lot of things that I think sort of evoke other things. I mean, the origin here is from the previous SummerSlam, where Daniel Bryan beats John Cena in a match of two good guys and beats him cleanly and he gets this big win after he's had this, you know, windfall of support from the fans for a couple of years. And he wins that match immediately. It's his big moment. And then it's undercut immediately when Triple H, the referee, turns against him and Randy Orton cashes his Money in the Bank. And there's a new authority regime. And, you know, I view that as pretty similar to a, you know, kind of a finger poke of doom type thing. to kind of kickstart that off. This worked out better than that did, but I do feel like that sort of evokes that in my mind.
Right, the sort of, like, everything is going well. The good guys seem to be winning. Like, we finally seem to be on the track that patient wrestling fans have been waiting for a long time. And then the hammer comes down.
Exactly. And then Daniel Bryan kind of, he and Randy Orton have multiple matches during that fall. And Bryan, you know, even wins those matches, and then you know the victory is overturned, or Shawn Michaels turns against him, or you know what have you. He sort of
Shawn Michaels turned against him, right?
Yeah. He sort of moved into a side storyline with the Wyatts. He even turns heel very briefly, but then like 3 weeks later, it's revealed to all be a ruse, and he ends up being even more wildly popular when he destroys Bray Wyatt in a cage. And then, of course, I guess the galvanizing moment of this is a match that he's not even part of, the 2014 Royal Rumble, where the fans are expecting him to be there, and he is not there, and they register the disapproval by booing every moment after the number 30 entrant Rey Mysterio came in.
Oh, poor Rey Mysterio, man.
He did get a little bit of a shaft there. And then the chosen winner is Batista, who is coming off about a 4-year layover from not being involved in wrestling. He comes in, he wins it. He is the fans do not react well to him. Surprise, surprise. Sort of a combination between another part-timer and another bodybuilder, you know, taking the place of our favorite nerd. And, but the course correction, Daniel Bryan is, entered into this. Also the characters of Stephanie McMahon and Triple H are sort of shifted from bad guys that you just want to turn off the TV into bad guys who are actually sort of engrossing and, you know, are hateable, but are hateable in a more entertaining way. And then everything kind of comes up roses.
Very much roses. I mean, if you were to tell me a year before this all happened that Stephanie McMahon of the WWE fame would have been like the most engrossing villain on TV, I kind of would have laughed at you, but she was amazing.
She was
during
good. And
this
Triple
whole
H,
thing.
Triple H was great too.
And I mean, Triple H was so good. Like, yeah. I feel like they were finally playing the characters that they played in 2000, but maybe just didn't have the actual gravitas to play.
Sure.
Right? Now they actually had like you really believed them.
Yeah, and they were tapping into, you know, like a perception of them from a lot of, you know, from a lot of obsessed fans who, you know, kind of feel like they're responsible for a lot of the evils that are going on. And instead of like trying to consistently like reject that notion, they just embraced it.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can look at it both ways, and both ways are fair. You can look at it as, you know, the best character to play on TV is yourself, which is sort of the cynical viewpoint of this.
Sure.
Because then you're sort of saying, oh, no, they actually were those people making the decisions that I don't approve of. Or you can say that they're just incredibly observant performers and have been able to successfully play off this idea.
So why do you think that Daniel Bryan is this, like, crazy unifying figure who in our splintered wrestling culture, when we can, you know, barely agree on anything, we seem to almost everyone seems to love him and is galvanized toward him?
Well, I think this is one of those rare moments where the most attractive, strongest, tallest, best looking, and most dashing, charismatic, best talker, not really a great wrestler, but, you know, like all those things put together, like this is one of those times where that guy really is just the best guy in the room, you know, and that's Daniel Bryan, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, you know, a lot of it is obviously that he's playing an underdog to an extent. And that certainly, well, he's playing that. That's an extent of his appeal. But I do think that, like, there's just, like, I think the personality of just, you know, having uncommon, you know, decency, kindness, and humility, just an authenticity of like, okay, this is really like this, at least is able to portray this guy who just you is instantly likable. Even when he's playing a villain, he's just instantly likable and seems like a fellow you want to spend time with. And obviously he is, you know, one of the most skilled wrestlers just athletically. And he's a guy, even though he's smaller, is able to kind of wrestle big.
Yeah, it's weird to say in professional wrestling, like jokes about his good looks aside. It's weird to say, but you believe Daniel Bryan. Daniel Bryan is a believable pro wrestler.
Right.
And I also don't know if he's a believable anything else. And I feel like both of those things are equally important. Long-term wrestling fans, people who watch the show for years and see the cycles of characters come and go, and hopefully know better than to get too attached to anybody, although we all really suffer from that. Long-term wrestling fans, I feel, are fans of not necessarily just like technical wrestling skill, although that does often go hand in hand. But I think we're fans of people who really, really want to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And Daniel Bryan like wants to be there more than anybody else. And I feel like that more than anything, more than his fantastic wrestling ability, more than his ability to get a good match out of just about anybody, I feel like his like desire to actually do this and not other things is his like shining thing. And that's perfect against the opponents that he has at WrestleMania 30, because you have Triple H, who wants to be a wrestler, but really wants power more than anything else. And that's canonical within his fictional character.
Mm-hmm.
And you have Batista, who is no longer a wrestler at this point. Like, yes, he's wrestling, but that's not his day job anymore. And he clearly wanted to go do other stuff instead of being a wrestler. I do want to circle back to Batista, though, because I feel like he doesn't actually fit into the part-time wrestler thing as badly as The Rock did. But then you have Randy Orton as well, who I feel like Randy Orton, even though I couldn't really see him doing anything else, I don't know if he really wants to be there or if this is just kind of the best thing going for him.
Yeah. I mean, he obviously like works hard and has wrestling talent, but he doesn't seem like, he's very much an afterthought here. You know, it's like there's, I mean, he's the fourth most important person, maybe the fifth most important person behind Stephanie, in this whole saga, you know, and he plays his role fine, but there's just he just like he doesn't stand out in any way other than just being, you know, regular Randy Orton. Maybe we've just seen Randy Orton for so long. There's nothing, he doesn't have anything really new in the bag of tricks.
Yeah, I feel like he plays his role here really well though. In being just the bad guy champion. Like that's just the character he's playing here, because it wouldn't have worked with Batista as champion, because Batista has to play the role of like the authority is in charge of this wrestling show, and the authority has to make a match between two people in the main event of WrestleMania, and they already have one of them in the pocket, and their plan was to have the other one in the pocket.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's it's important that Batista isn't playing both of those characters.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense. That makes sense. This is also tapping into, you know, this Yes Movement idea is tapping into kind of like a rise of fan activism over the past few years, and of like fans have used the power they have to sort of change the events of WWE. Just sort of rejecting what WWE is bringing to them and trying to like shape those events through their reactions to things more and more. It feels like that it's more organized. It feels like fans have kind of realized that power and, you know, kind of wielded it in interesting ways. What do you make of all this?
I mean, I kind of wonder in what other area have they actually been successful?
Well,
and if they were actually successful in this one, the perception is certainly there that the fans demanded this to happen, and at some point in time, eventually WWE acquiesced.
Yeah,
right. That the perception of that is certainly true, and certainly they play up on that in the story.
Sure,
even in sort of the postmortems of this story, they play up on the fact that, well, the fans demanded this happen, so we had to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I still think circumstance maybe had made this happen more than anything else.
Sure.
And this year's WrestleMania 31, I believe, backs up the idea that if WWE has a plan, and if nothing catastrophic happens to get in the way of the plan, they're going to go through with their plan.
Yeah. So do you view the reaction to Batista as more disastrous than the reaction to Roman Reigns?
No, I actually think that the reaction to Roman Reigns is worse, because Roman Reigns will still be here after a few months.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're stuck with Roman Reigns for a while, and we all kind of knew that Batista's run would be a 5-6 month thing and then out.
Sure.
And they made the right, I think they made the right decision to the narrative to do what they did with WrestleMania 30, but I still believe that had more to do with CM Punk leaving a sort of massive hole in WrestleMania.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that was a factor. Of course, they seem to sort of change the plan with Bryan before that, you know, because obviously I don't think the Wyatt story was intended to be a 3-week arc.
No.
So I think they were bringing Bryan back and they were planning to put him in the, you know, in the main event picture somehow.
Maybe. And he may have, and it still may have ended up being a triple threat match, but I still feel like WrestleMania 30 isn't as special without Daniel Bryan bookending the show.
Well, that's absolutely fair. Yeah. I don't know. It's somewhat of a who knows situation, because obviously,
right.
And I presume that WWE has, you know, they obviously have their plan, but they would be pretty dumb if they didn't have at least a few contingency plans based on.
Of course,
yeah.
Of course.
So,
however, I will, as a sort of special thing to guess, I will share my thoughts on Daniel Bryan this year for the WrestleMania 31 build.
Sure,
but we'll do that later on.
Okay. All right. That's fine. So I guess we'll get into the first match. And I mean, there are many fantastic aspects about this match, but probably my favorite part of it is Triple H's entrance.
Oh, my God.
It is gloriously over the top. There
uh-huh.
begins with classical music, and he is revealed with basically, like, he has sort of like a gold version of the old Grayskull mask.
Mm-hmm.
With a crown and armor and a red robe. There are, I guess you might describe them as wenches, who are at the throne surrounding him, attending to his needs.
Mm-hmm.
And then after this, it's like a minute or so of this, you know, just we're regaled with Triple H's wonderfulness. His usual music starts, and he marches to the ring upon it. But it is quite like this is clearly like embracing the past, you know, entrances where he's, you know, he's you know, Conan the Barbarian or mm-hmm. or things like that, and just taking it to another absurd level.
It's a nice culmination of his fancy WrestleMania entrances. Like they wisely put the giant skull entrance thing behind him so that it wouldn't like shoot him with that weird fog that he got at the previous year's WrestleMania.
That's right. Yes. Yes.
they put everything together and then put everything in the right spot.
Which is.
Yeah. The addition of the three fantastic women wrestlers from NXT is a wonderful touch.
Sorry for describing them as wenches. I mean, I feel like they were playing the role of wenches, I should say.
Yes.
I did not know those were NXT. I've never actually watched a full episode of NXT. I have to admit that. So the
women were Sasha Banks, current NXT Women's Champion, Summer Rae, who is now on regular WWE TV, and Charlotte Flair.
Okay, I've heard all their names. So
yes,
there you go.
Although she doesn't use Flair as her last name, although she's totally Charlotte Flair.
Yeah. Well, I guess in theory you could say that Daniel Bryan also beat a Flair in this.
That's right. You could definitely say it. So there you go. All four members of Evolution are present.
Yeah. And Stephanie is wonderful here. I love when Triple H stands on the turnbuckle during his entrance, and Stephanie's extremely intense clapping behind him.
Stephanie deserves so much praise for her performance. Not just as the announcer and like her outfit, but just like as somebody around the ring doing the best job of annoying person around the ring that you could possibly do.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen anyone fulfill that role of like ringside bad guy who isn't actually physically threatening.
Mm-hmm.
Better than her.
Yeah. She's excellent. She's
it's as if she grew up watching Sensational Sherry and was like, how do I do just like the perfect Sherry?
That's a pretty good way of putting it. I mean, obviously without the physical element, but which is a big part of what Sherry did, but yes, the there is absolutely that not quite as much menace, but you're definitely definitely in that vein.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I like about this match is that it is like it is a very technical match.
I mean, we are just kind of going to gush on this one, right?
I would say so. I mean, yeah. I mean, there is a lot of cool stuff, and every time like it turns into Triple H's type of match, like something happens with Bryan where he is able to kind of bring it back to his match.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like there's a lot of stuff, and you know, Triple H is, you know, he's you know, a lot of it is based, of course, on Triple H. Daniel Bryan's shoulder's already injured, so he's trying to, you know, attack that. He's, you know, he's using chicken wings, he's cross faces, he's, you know,
he's using moves that. He's either never used before or very rarely used before.
Yeah, I mean, later in the match, after Daniel Bryan gets a couple of German suplexes, Triple H counters and then hits a dragon suplex.
Or a tiger suplex, I believe.
Isn't a dragon suplex, isn't that a full Nelson suplex, or is that a tiger suplex? What's a dragon suplex? Why am I...
Man.
Some kind of suplex. Some sort of animal suplex.
Yeah, no, definitely some sort of animal.
Yes.
Yeah.
No,
a dragon suplex is a full Nelson suplex. A tiger suplex.
He's holding the arms from the back.
Are hooked underneath.
There you go. Yes, you are correct. Yeah. I'm sorry. I.
That's okay.
I feel
this
like
this is pretty deep, close to the metal here.
One thing I also really like is just how like. A lot of these complex moves, like they're not long after that, Triple H tries a superplex, but then Bryan turns it into basically a sunset flip powerbomb. Mm-hmm. And I like how so many of these seem like they require like labor and effort rather than it just being like, you know, once you get the guy in position, it's fairly easy to land that move. Like everything is like requires strain and requires, it's very physical without being like super violent.
Mm-hmm. This is one of my favorite wrestling matches, period. Now, mm-hmm. This changes like historical top 10 lists for me, both at WrestleMania and in general.
Yeah.
It's easily one of my favorite Triple H matches.
Yeah.
And maybe my favorite like fair Triple H match, like one that doesn't have a lot of gimmick or cheating, you know?
Sure.
Frankly, I can't remember very many really good ones that don't involve gimmicks or cheating.
Yeah, that's sort of his thing.
Yeah, it's absolutely his thing.
Well, it's a lot of people's thing, but yeah.
It's pro wrestling.
Sure.
But it's the kind of match that makes me go, A, Triple H, why aren't you wrestling like this more often? or why didn't you wrestle like this more often? Is it because you feel like this kind of wrestling is boring? Or is it because you can only do it with a performer the caliber of a Daniel Bryan?
Yeah. It would be my second guess.
Right. But then again, I feel like Triple H didn't really wrestle this kind of match when he had other guys like him. Like, when he had really technical wrestlers as opponents. Like, even the Benoit matches were juiced up.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, those were an era, you know, I think there may have been different expectations for, you know, for matches and when he was on top more, and I guess, you know, yeah. kind of what he was expecting, the sort of the repetition of the match based on what he was doing. That's an excellent question. I mean, there are, you know, he's had some decent technical matches, but I assume that it's just because a lot of it has to do with Brian's skill, and a lot of it has to do with, you know, they're not trying to. I mean, you know, because it would in a way make sense for them to have an all out brawl, you know, based on the you know, the amount that they hate each other and the amount, you know, the kind of the size and scale of the match. But it is, yeah, I mean, in some ways it is reminiscent of, you know, probably the other candidate for best opening match in WrestleMania history, which is, you know, Owen Hart and Bret Hart at 10.
Absolutely. And I honestly wonder if they went with technical because they wanted to outdo that one. Because they were like, you know what? That match has stood as one of the best WrestleMania matches for 30 years. Let's go out and blow the roof off that match.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which makes me so angry that people haven't tried to do that with like Savage and Steamboat.
Well, I don't think you're going to beat Savage Steamboat.
That's,
you know, yeah.
That's a high bar.
Yeah, it's probably not. I mean, like, I just don't think, like, yeah, like, other matches that are great, like, you can see other people doing that match. I don't think I can see anybody other than Savage Steamboat doing that match.
I could see, like Jericho and Regal doing that match, and that's about it. Yeah. And they wrestled. They wrestled an opening match at WrestleMania at 17. Well, and right, it was so not that good.
No, not yeah. I think somebody, I mean, Regal is a technical, but you need somebody who can jump around more, you know? And Jericho was never quite that good. I mean, he was really good, obviously, but.
Sure.
Yeah. But, I mean, I could see, like, yeah, like Daniel Bryan would be, I could see him playing Steamboat. I don't know who would play Savage. Like, I mean, I guess that's the thing. Like, no one else was Savage, so.
I can't think of any other WrestleMania main, like WrestleMania match, or really any match in WWE that was like this. Really, this is a Vader Sting template, where like Triple H is just so much bigger than Daniel Bryan. It's almost laughable.
Yeah, and there's the part where, you know, Bryan hits the two leg kicks in the corner, and then the third one he just runs in this massive Triple H clothesline. It is like reminiscent of you know, it's like he's running into just this huge guy, and Triple H is like a huge guy, but I never thought of him as like, you know, oh my god, he's a big wrestler. I guess compared to the guys who usually wrestled, Rock and Austin and
exactly
those types,
Triple H never seemed that big until you put him next to people who would definitely just be considered a cruiserweight. Like, if Daniel Bryan wrestled in 1997 WCW, they would have never put him in a heavyweight match.
Yeah. Which was a little bit of the mentality WCW would have, but he wouldn't have done any better in WWE either at the time.
Yeah, that's very true.
Sure. But Bryan still, you know, he stands with him and at him, and he's completely, some of the smaller guys, I do have a hard time sometimes seeing them just work well with the big guys, because sometimes the size disparity does get a little bit too much for me. But this is not a problem at all. You know, it's just because Brian's so tough and so physical, and so you know, he's able to dish what he can take too. But yeah, he can also fill that underdog, the typical underdog stuff as well.
Especially when you get to something like a Pedigree, you really see the size difference there.
Yeah.
Because, like if Daniel Bryan is sort of doubled over in front of Triple H, he barely looks like an adult. it's a huge size difference. And that's why it's like Sting Vader, because you don't think of Sting as a small guy, and you think of Vader as a really big guy, but you don't necessarily think of of Vader being as fast as Sting, but he sometimes was. And you don't think of Sting being as strong as Vader, but he sometimes was.
Yeah.
And that's the issue here, too, where it's like there's a huge size difference, but that's literally the only difference. Daniel Bryan is really strong.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And Triple H is really fast when he wants to be.
Sure. Yeah. And he deserves a lot of credit for really bringing it here, you know, even though, like you said, he didn't wrestle much and he's older and, you know, doesn't quite have the same speed and everything, but yeah, I mean, he, you know, for this night, I mean, he really did actually, you know, and he followed it up with a couple of really good performances and tag matches against Evolution, or with Evolution against the Shield. So you know, for a few months, he really had it going.
That's, it's not a bad three act story of WrestleMania. If you treat this match and the main event as one match, like, and then you treat the Extreme Rules and then the Over the Limit, or no, Payback was the name of the pay per view, right?
I don't know, but whatever it was, one of the May pay per view, whatever that was.
Unloaded or whatever.
It might have been June, but whatever. The
sure,
yeah. Who cares?
Overloaded. Who cares? Why do they even name them anymore?
I don't know. Well, I'm sure there are people who keep track of it, but we are not those people.
Bastards.
We've just moved on.
But if you look at those,
for the
three
record,
matches,
it was Payback.
It was Payback.
Yes.
If you look at those three matches, you see actually a really fantastic narrative arc between for like the characters in Evolution.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because you slowly see the whole thing reform and then fall apart in three matches.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's a good way of putting it. Yeah, and it's too bad, you know, that Daniel Bryan suffered his injury right after that. He was also put into a feud with Kane that was not the most advisable thing they could have ever done. And
kidding.
And suffered his injury as well. So basically, didn't have a chance to, you know, really be part of anything significant after this. I mean, I don't know if he would have necessarily fit exactly in with the Shield story, or you know what he could have done outside of it. But you know, it's too bad that he had to kind of miss out on that. But they were able. I mean, the fact that they were able to slide Evolution and Shield together and sort of make that work, I thought it was pretty good.
I mean, 2014 is the year of, oh my God, what ifs.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I think we have a Twitter question actually about a what if that we should totally talk about later.
I agree. It reminds me to actually bring up the Twitter questions because I forgot to have them up on here. So I will make sure I do. But
let's finish up on the opening match here.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I'll just kind of go through a little bit of the finish that last few minutes. So Triple H hits a pedigree, but it only gets two. The announcers, of course, play this up as an unbelievable event. Triple H looks disheartened and spent in the corner. Stephanie tries to cheer him up and boost him on. Bryan is able to get a quick small package for two. It does not successful, though. And then Triple H keeps viciously, repeatedly punching Bryan's head in the corner. There is another attempt at a pedigree, but then Bryan turns him over and is able to get a two count. The arms are still locked, so they flip over and Triple H tries the pedigree again, but then Bryan blocks it. There's one more attempt, but then Bryan slips out. He's able to land a big kick. Triple H then counters another kick into a back suplex attempt. But then Bryan slips out again. He hits the running knee and he wins the match to great acclaim. And it is a nice, it's just a great, you know, few minutes of finishing. I mean, there's a lot of cool stuff in this match. Some, you know, some cool reversals on submission stuff. I mean, there's, you know, there's some of the typical stuff that we've seen before. But two things that I think were really great about this. One is there wasn't like a bunch of like, you know, I hit my finish, you hit your finish, and like we're just gonna, you know, be on the ground for 5 minutes and then we're gonna get up and do all that stuff. Yeah, finisher spam type stuff. And the other thing that I think was really great is like this match, like there was no point in which the crowd was like trying to insert themselves or to like cheer it as like a sort of like you know, like a This Is Awesome or that kind of chant. Like, this was all about, like, people rooting for Daniel Bryan to beat Triple H and being really happy when Daniel Bryan was about to win and being really mad when Triple H was about to win. And it was very much a, you know, old type of reaction feeling type of thing, which I always appreciate.
As cynical as we can all be, I don't think anybody denies that this match, you watch it again, you watch it over again, and you still get the feeling. Like, I watched this match 24 hours ago, and I still got turned into an 8-year-old.
Yeah.
Knowing the finish.
Sure.
Like, it retreats you. It puts you exactly in the mindset of the most passionate wrestling fan that you can possibly be.
Yeah.
And full credit to them for doing that, because, like, they've put us through a lot to get to this moment. And it wasn't always in service of getting to this moment.
Absolutely. One minor negative is that Jerry Lawler is really trying to make WrestleMania happen, and it's just not happening, Jerry.
I didn't hear the commentary at all.
Oh, there you go.
I'm not even kidding. I've become so good at tuning them out. It's a skill. It's a muscle that you can, like, work on.
Yeah.
I don't hear them anymore.
I don't listen to them that as close as I used to. But I do, you know, I mean, I, WrestleMania didn't, like, you know, make me, like, I didn't groan when I heard it, but I definitely was like, oh, okay, that's just not going to happen, buddy. So,
I think even by WrestleMania 30, I was like, you guys are just like Peanuts teachers now. it's not even words.
There you go. Yeah.
And from what I hear, they're not even real words half the time when you do hear them.
Probably not. No. So to finish, Stephanie slaps Brian repeatedly in the face, and then Triple H attacks him from behind and then grabs his arm and takes it over to the ring post and then grabs a chair and then slams it. So and the announcers get very sad.
And then and only slams it once.
Yeah.
Like, what a wonderful, like, point of restraint. You know, just be like, you only need to do it once.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's perfect.
He doesn't want him to not be in the match, because, you know, people obviously paid money to see a three-way in the end, so, you know, he's not going to take out the guy entirely. He's just going to take him out enough that he can't win.
Huh. Stephanie's face when the three count is made is the best face in WrestleMania history. It's better than Vince McMahon's bloody face at WrestleMania 19.
Ooh.
It's totally better than that. It's totally better than that. It matches the moment perfectly. And that was the only good moment at WrestleMania 19.
Well, no, that was the one where Jericho kicked Shawn Michaels in the balls.
That one's good too.
Yeah.
It's good too. A lot of good faces.
Yeah, there were some good faces. So to the three-way, which is the finish. Randy Orton's theme is played live by the band that performs his theme. I don't know what the band's name is. There's no reason for us to say it. But I guess this is perhaps a concession for him being irrelevant throughout most of the proceedings.
It's kind of funny too. Every now and then they'll do this with a WrestleMania main event. They did it with the WrestleMania 29, where, like, it was clear everyone in the back was just tired by then. They were just like, let's not even play a video. Just fucking send them out, whatever.
Yeah, it's not quite the same as, like, the WrestleMania 28. Like, you know, both guys are, you know, getting, you know, a song's being performed fully beforehand, and then the guys are going to come out through their own music, and they're, you know, The Rock's going to shake Pitbull's hand, and, you know, and all that, and then Machine Gun Kelly is going to, you know, be excited about John Cena.
Can I just say, it's been nice, because you and I have done WrestleMania 27 through 30 now.
Yes.
And we're finally going to talk about a WrestleMania main event that wasn't horrible. I enjoyed WrestleMania 27, 28, 29, and 30. I enjoyed all four shows. But the main events of 27, 28, and 29
were
a lot of work to get through.
Yeah, Yeah. So. 28's the only one of those where I'm like, yeah, you know, it was fine. The other two, yeah.
I think we were the nicest to that one, yeah.
I agree, yeah.
But this match,
This is rather good. I like Batista. I like Batista's black and white black and green scheme
black
for
and
his
green scheme.
Yeah, his trunks and his boots. They are
and again, much like earlier, we talked about at Extreme Rules. He goes, does he go blue or red? I believe he goes blue. He has the same trunks, but they're blue. And then at Payback, he goes red.
No, I think. I thought,
or is it the other way around?
I thought he had blue. I think because Blutista was the, I believe that was the last match.
That was the second one, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, he's got this awesome color scheme that, like, at first, it just kind of makes your eye twitch. Like, there's nothing wrong with it per se, but it's just not him.
Yeah.
And it's really funny when he's standing next to Orton and Triple H, and they're both, like, wearing perfect evil black.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just, like, sitting there with red, blue, and green.
He's a colorful man.
He's a colorful man.
He can't help it.
But he's smart. But like bad guy Batista, and I swear to God, this is half the reason people booed Batista. Half of it was Daniel Bryan's omission in the Rumble. Absolutely. But half of it was just because wrestling fans are smart and have memories. And last time Batista was around, he was playing a bad guy so well.
Yes.
That we just didn't want to hear it about this idea of Batista being a good character again.
Because it was
just
nope. It was ridiculous. Yeah, I mean,
he's
just
stupid.
The way that he dresses, the way that he acts, he's a villain.
Of course he is.
Yeah,
he's a great villain.
He's an outstanding villain, and he ended up being, you know, good in this match and good in his little run. You know,
terrific.
Yeah, so it all worked out. But like, I wonder if anybody in WWE was like. Okay, yeah, you know, when once they're like trying to bring him back as a good guy, they were like, you know, this probably isn't going to be a good idea.
Yeah,
I mean, there's got to be somebody who's smart enough to kind of realize, like, yeah, people aren't going to go for this because
it's not that we don't want him here. We do.
Yeah,
Batista's great.
We're fine.
We all
with him
like
here.
Batista.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if we don't all we should all like Batista as
all like
as
Batista.
A bad guy, but maybe we don't all like him. But
yeah, but like come around, be part of the show. We're awesome. Just don't be a hero.
Yeah. No, don't be here. Yeah, he's the number one guy where you use that line to. Like, if this is a cop,
exactly.
If this is a cop drama, you know, that's the first thing you tell him. Don't be a hero.
Don't be a hero.
Yeah. So,
some guys can play good and bad. He shouldn't.
Yeah, absolutely. So this has a similar dynamic to me is in WrestleMania 20, and obviously them mm-hmm. being in comments a three way where. The portions in which Daniel Bryan is not in the match, the crowd does not care, and the crowd
not
wants Daniel Bryan
bit.
To be there. No, and then the parts where he is involved, they are very happy to see him,
mm-hmm.
and they're very excited.
Mm-hmm. Which is alarming, considering what they did 20 minutes before this match.
That would be, of course, the Undertaker.
Yes.
Okay.
Like, if there was any moment that would absolutely kill 80,000 people's enthusiasm for professional wrestling,
yes,
it's it's that.
Right. Yes. That is that
and
is absolutely
they sent,
true.
They sent all of the women out a few minutes after that happened.
That's right.
And not one of them got one iota of reaction.
Yes.
Those poor performers.
Yeah.
But the exact same thing happened at WrestleMania 18 after Hogan and Rock just depleted all of the energy in the arena.
Sure.
And they sent out the women to zero reaction. But unlike WrestleMania 18, when the main event came on, people perked up.
Yeah, people were happy. People were, people love Daniel Bryan an awful lot.
Yes, they really, really, really do.
They do.
What's your theory? Do people like Daniel Bryan, or do they like just kind of doing the yes thing?
I think they like Daniel Bryan a lot. I think the yes thing helps, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
I think people love doing the yes thing, too, but they wouldn't love it as much if they didn't love Daniel Bryan.
There was an interview not too long ago where Daniel Bryan was like, I think people like just doing the yes thing.
Well, that's part of the appeal, the humility, you know? Just the... you know, he's not a guy who's all about him. I mean, because we have this like thing that's like ingrained in pro wrestling where we think like our wrestling characters need to be like bold and like, you know, braggarts, and just they you know, they need to like have, you know, this like this attitude and touting themselves and being 110%. Like that's all like, you know, and that's true for a lot of guys. Mm-hmm. But I do think for Daniel Bryan, he's, you know, perfectly suited toward being, you know, a very close to a version of himself. Like,
I hope so. Yeah, I mean, that guy would be a great guy.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, there's obviously character difference in there, but you know, I'm gonna go ahead and guess that there's a lot of him in the performer.
Yeah, I feel like if who he really is his character on WWE. Television and something like his character on Total Divas, I'm fine with that.
Yeah,
he's great.
What's his character? What's the difference in his character on Total Divas? Because I've never seen Total Divas. So,
well, his voice is a little more nasally.
Oh, okay.
Because he gets punched in the head a lot, so that happens.
Yeah, well,
yeah,
it's fair.
A lot of wrestlers get that nasal thing going.
Yeah. Well, I never thought about that, but that doesn't make an awful lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
I watched the Daniel Bryan, the special they had after WrestleMania, where they had like the behind the scenes where they showed him like his whole week leading up to it. Have you seen that?
I did. It's a good little documentary.
It is. Yeah.
It's funny. That came out about a week after WrestleMania.
Right.
They couldn't have made it beforehand because it contains the matches and the results and stuff.
Sure.
But it's fantastic. The subsequent ones that they've done with the Shield and the Usos are they use the exact same template, but because neither of those people are Daniel Bryan, it's not as good.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're both actually pretty entertaining. Like they're good sort of, I actually prefer them over the like career retrospective documentaries that WWE produces. I have a lot of problems with those. But because the documentary only actually gets to talk about a few days of time, they throw in a lot more detail.
And yeah.
Pretty
it's
entertaining.
Nice. I will say after watching that, I felt much more bad. I felt worse that she wasn't able to celebrate with him at the end of the match.
Mm.
I think that would have been because she said something later where, you know, she, you know, wish she'd been able to go out there and they wouldn't let her go out there to celebrate. But I could like, oh, you know, like it. I mean, I felt bad about it at the time, but just looking at them and, you know, and I just kind of felt like, oh, even worse that she wasn't able to be out there with him on to celebrate his big moment.
Much, you know, and I think you and I have talked about this many times, but there's certain parts of the WWE like rule book, and I don't mean like their matches, like how they present a show, that is really jarring to people who like other kinds of drama or other types of wrestling.
Sure.
And especially to older WCW fans, where you would often see one character react differently to different situations.
Yes.
Like you'd get a Lex Luger who was a bad guy to some wrestlers, but a good guy to other wrestlers.
Yeah.
Right. And I personally think that WWE could handle, like the audience could handle the fact that Brie Bella is a bad character in regards to the stories with her sister and other women and her actual performances, but is also a good character in her relationship.
Right.
I think we could emotionally put that together.
I think we probably could.
It doesn't create too much of a dissonance.
No, it doesn't. Especially, you know, this isn't 1981. You know, I mean,
yeah,
we see these people in, you know, out of character interviews, and we see them on Twitter, and we see, you know,
right.
We're understanding, and the audience has, you know, largely accepted that difference. So,
yeah, I think it would be fine. I don't think you need to make Brie Bella good just because they've decided to put her on TV with Daniel Bryan.
Sure.
Because that's entirely what they did.
Yeah. And they did a nice job, I guess, of taking sort of the, you know, since Bryan himself could not wrestle, they did a nice job of taking the momentum from this and leading to a better than it had any right to be Brie-Stephanie feud during the summer.
To which I put all the credit on Stephanie.
Well, yeah. Well, yeah,
Brie is great.
Yeah, I like Brie better than most people do. But
that match was phenomenal.
Well, yeah, it was well done. I mean, yeah, I mean, Stephanie's character work is on another level. Yeah, I mean, Brie was fine.
Oh, it really is.
But
yeah.
Yes, absolutely. So some highlights, I would say, Orton busts out the Garvin Stomp, which I'm always excited about.
Oh,
even though I think Joe Drilling hates the Garvin Stomp, but
this is like Randy Orton's best match ever, basically. even though he's a total afterthought,
yeah,
he wrestles so perfectly here and hits everything perfectly, and like gets a few moments of good bad guy time.
Sure,
like he does get some moments of being in control. It's one of the things I love about this match so much is that nothing's rushed. Like, they get, 40 minutes of time?
Right, yeah, roughly.
Including
entrances and things, yes.
Everything, yeah, about sure. 40 minutes, this whole scene.
Yeah.
Nothing is rushed. All three guys get plenty of time to do everything they want to do,
mm-hmm.
including the thing that Randy Orton loves to do most is stand there with no emotion on his face.
Yes. that is his favorite thing.
Right, like he clears the ring with everybody and then he just stands there and kind of like does the, and this is where you need that 80-inch 4K TV. That's when you appreciate Randy Orton, is that you get the really subtle movements in his face.
Yes, they are subtle. He is a master of subtlety.
I've always said this about Orton, like he's like before HD, Randy Orton might as well have been Gilbert. Like it does, who cared?
Right.
But the second they turned over to HD, he started to matter.
Yeah, well,
because you can finally see the guy and perform.
Yeah, it's a small moment. and you know, one thing that I that was really noticeable is there are three or four times where Brian has been taken out of the match through whatever circumstance, and Batista and Order are fighting for a while, and then Brian jumps on back in. And every single time it happens, it's behind the camera. So we don't see him coming in. We don't see him until he actually enters, you know, like he hits somebody with a move and a screen. It's every time it's, you know, kind of like it's done as sort of a surprise.
The headbutt off the top rope, especially, he really comes out of absolutely nowhere there.
And
the crowd seems to have not seen him.
Right. And I mean, and certainly they do that. You know, I've seen three-way matches where they've done that before, but not every time. Like, I don't recall it ever happening every single time that they, you know, try to kind of get him involved.
I have to insert a piece of criticism here, not because it's specific to this match, but because almost every sort of big deal triple threat match in WWE has this problem, is that they're just incapable of having three guys wrestle one another. Like they just have no idea how to do it. So one guy always has to get knocked off the apron so two people can do a spot.
Yeah. Well, in this case, at least Daniel Bryan, you know, they have the excuse of, you know, being hobbled by previous things. So that's an easy out for him to kind of be taken out of the match at certain points, and they're able to, you know, and that works fine. But you're right. I mean, that is a limitation inherent in the formula. It is difficult to have three people wrestle at the same time effectively.
How many triple threat matches do they have? And they've just never come up with three-person wrestling moves.
I've seen like double sleepers occasionally, but they always kind of look corny.
They look corny, right? Like,
yeah.
It always takes me back to that. One of my favorite triple threat matches ever was, it was in early '98, like maybe Spring Stampede '98 or something like that. It was Raven, DDP, and Benoit.
Yes. Uncensored, actually, but yes.
Uncensored, yeah. And there's so many good three-person wrestling moves in that match, and they never really separate, the three of them.
Right.
It's one of the few times that you see three people consistently fight each other the whole match.
Yeah.
It's not easy to do, and it's not easy to do without doing sort of hackneyed, sort of Young Bucks-style crappy tag team moves.
Yeah. Not a Young Bucks fan?
I it's a long story.
All right, that's fair.
I like them, but they tend to lean a little too heavily on the let's just stack people. They do a lot of like move on a move stuff, and it takes me out of it somehow. I don't know.
Okay, That's a sort of a traditionalist point of view from you, which is which I would not expect. I mean, you know, it's okay. I mean, that's fine.
Good guys shouldn't punch.
All right, Vern Gagne.
I know.
So, yeah, kind of the.
When did I become 85?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I guess you do enough of these with me, and you know, eventually you're just gonna age in dog years. I don't know how it works, but anyway. So there's a point in the match in which eventually Orton and Batista decide to sort of double team Bryan outside.
So that's the beginning of the third act of the match, yeah. Right? So you actually have a nice structure here,
yeah.
Where the first 10 minutes or so, it's kind of a legitimate triple threat match. Batista has reasons to fight Orton. Orton has reasons to fight Batista. And Bryan gets in like 4 moves.
Sure.
And they both hate him more than they hate each other.
Right.
And that rift grows. Like, and they both hate him a lot more by the end of the match and like each other a little bit more.
Yeah.
Or at least hate each other less. Which is nice. It's nice to see that kind of character progression actually happen in a match.
Yeah. It was rare, especially in a format such as this. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, and then the second act happens... just in and around the Triple H interference.
Right.
Right. So Bryan starts to get a good amount of offense. It appears that he's actually a contender in this match as opposed to someone who's going to just lay around like a piece of meat for most of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the crowd like comes alive when Triple H comes in.
Right.
And there's this amazing cathartic feeling when... Because... Everyone has been watching every single moment of the last 8 months, and you see the Triple H interference, and you're like, oh, they're going to do it again.
Right.
Right? And so not only does Triple H interfere, he knocks out the referee, pulls out the referee, right? Brings in Scott Armstrong, which is a reference from months ago.
Yeah.
Right? It's not a recent reference. Like that, the Scott Armstrong thing happened in what, November?
I forget exactly, but around then, October, November, I would think. Yeah, yeah.
And I didn't even realize that Scott Armstrong hadn't been on the show since then. Like, that's such a fine detail from a company not exactly known for fine details.
Right.
You know, and so the
although, honestly, it would have been slightly better if they'd used Nick Patrick, but...
Wouldn't it, though?
Yeah.
My heart.
Yeah.
Because then it would have really tied in. Just
yes, that would have made it perfect. I don't. Is he even still around?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. But
I mean, what else would he be doing?
I mean, that's a good point. Yeah.
My roommate the other day, just out of nowhere, he asked like, is Earl Hebner still refereeing? And I'm like, that's complicated. So many questions about, like, general wrestling knowledge, I just answer with, well, that's complicated.
He apparently retired in 2008, so.
Oh, okay.
Due to back injury, so. There you go.
So, yeah, he brings in Scott Armstrong, and that's the real black moment of the match, where you remember all the pain and suffering you felt as a wrestling fan for the last 8 months / 20 years of getting screwed out of the thing you want to see happen. And in those few seconds where Scott Armstrong is counting, not a fast count, by the way.
Yeah. Well, Nick Patrick was not good at fast counts either, so.
No, I suppose not. But when Bryan kicks out, it's like, oh my god, they're actually going to do it. I feel like that's the moment that you know the end of the match.
Sure.
Because if Bryan kicks out of this, if he kicks out of Triple H interference and crooked referee, there's no way he's losing.
Yeah. And it's at that moment where Triple H grabs the sledgehammer and goes up to the apron, but then Bryan... grabs it from him and then runs and nails him with it, knocking him off the apron. And then I guess right before then, he had actually dove out of the ring and landed, hitting Triple H and Scott Armstrong, and Stephanie's right there and is knocked down as well. And then at the point, such a hammer happens. So eventually, this leads to Orton and Batista double teaming Daniel Bryan outside. They take him out, and then they sort of stare down for a few moments, and then suddenly clear all the monitors from all three tables. And they set up a Batista bomb into a reverse RKO. They break the table, but then Orton's back ends up hitting a monitor and hurts it. You see some blood in his back from some scratches. It appears to injure him severely, quite a bit, causing him a lot of pain. Bryan is still throughout this, and the announcers are all in hushed voices, about Daniel Bryan. The medics eventually come out and wheel him out on a stretcher. Batista does take a long time before he sort of attacks Orton. And then there's like a brief moment in the match where like Batista is more of the villain and Orton is acting as like the good guy. He's sort of fighting out from this like vicious attack, and it doesn't last long. Eventually, Orton kind of takes control, hits a DDT off of the apron onto the floor, and then is basically back to, what he was. But there's like a minute in the match where it's like Batista, like, beating up on the injured Orton and Orton trying to fight out of it. It's just a very, I don't know if it was quite improvised or what they were exactly doing there, or just they were filling some time, and that's just the way I took it. But it's just kind of funny
it does sort of stick out a little bit though, right?
Yeah, right.
Because you're like, so what are you doing now?
Yeah. Right.
Like maybe they're actually giving the audience a breather, because there was a lot of action leading up to that moment.
Sure. Sure.
And they need to let people breathe so that it can then. But it's weird to just have. It's really weird to have Batista just sort of stand there.
Right. I mean, my guess is Orton just needed some time to.
Gather himself. Whatever.
And whatever.
It's
fine. It doesn't bother me. It wasn't like. I mean, I noticed he waited a little bit long, but it wasn't like, oh my God, what are you doing? It's more like, part of what was going
on. Then again, though, that happens again at Extreme Rules and at Payback as well. There's moments in those triple threat matches where there just seems to be no action for like a solid 60 seconds to 2 minutes. And it's not entirely clear why. It's odd. I remember watching those and it's just like, and it was always when Batista was like in control.
Mm-hmm.
He always just kind of. He just like takes a minute, and nothing happens during that minute.
Yeah. Eventually, Bryan gets off the stretcher and he crawls back valiantly to the ring, we get to a point where Orton attacks him and takes a extremely long time to set up the RKO. You're standing in the ring with his facial expression, his very subtle facial expression. And I do like the Michael Cole line of explaining this as saying, Randy Orton is going to bask in this.
Yeah.
Which, I guess that's,
He
wants to make everybody suffer. Yeah. I mean,
this is what I'm saying. Everybody got to do their favorite thing.
Sure. does. So, we get to a point where.
Like, can someone who has, like, the Blu-ray of WrestleMania 30, can someone tell me what Randy Orton's actually doing in that moment? Because, like, us mere mortals that only have high definition TV can't see it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure he's doing something. I believe it. He's a good performer.
Yeah. He just has his things. We all have our stuff. Bryan is able to get yes locks both on Batista and on Orton, but they are both broken up. Then we get to a point where everyone is almost hitting their finishing moves on the other guys, but it is luckily that is not that is well done. It doesn't feel like, again, the finisher spam type stuff. Then Orton sets up his punt kick on Batista, but then Bryan runs in and lands his running knee. Batista then tosses Bryan out of the ring. He covers Orton for two. Batista then hits the Batista bomb on, or tries the Batista bomb on Orton, but Bryan, again coming from behind the camera, hits the running knee. Then he locks the Yes Lock for a few moments, not too long. I mean, probably 15 seconds maybe, and Batista taps. This is enough time for Michael Cole to scream, you know, tap, Batista tap. You know, it's just weird still for Michael Cole to be such a cheerleader for Daniel Bryan, given,
it's,
you know,
so weird.
Yeah, their history. And I like, there is just like after the bell rings and after, you know, Daniel Bryan is happy, there is a, you can see Orton on the apron, and there is a nice shot of like, oh, I missed my chance here from Orton. It is mm-hmm. it is subtle, but it's nice that they at least like got him in that view, you know. And then there is, of course, a great celebration. We pan across the crowd, everybody raising their arms and chanting yes. Bryan gets on his knees, holding a belt in each hand, and raises his hands up, and then goes to the announce table, and with the fireworks behind him, doing the yes chant again. Then back in the ring, and confetti covers everything. There's a little girl and a woman who come celebrate, which I later learn are his niece and his sister, which I made that assumption, but they are not identified. And then Lawler's line of "Sink it in, Daniel Bryan, this is magical," especially given the obstacles he has faced since then, is a nice life lesson from Jerry Lawler.
It is one of those times where everything before this was rough, and God knows everything after this was rough. But this moment, I don't know if it makes it all worth it, but they tried their damnedest to make it all worth it.
Yeah, I mean, they did it as about as well as they've done almost anything.
That might be the best compliment we can give them. This is the best thing that you can do with what you have and what you are willing to do.
Right. Yes. It's hard to imagine it coming off better and everyone doing better. And you know, it is hard to, I mean, it is just like, I mean, the whole show, like I, you know, this isn't necessarily the best WrestleMania in terms of like the best number of great matches or anything like that. But from top to bottom, I mean, this show was, you know, about as enjoyable of a WrestleMania experience as I've had.
I agree. It's so cohesive as a show.
Yeah.
I almost can't see WrestleMania 30 on a match-by-match basis.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it all feels like one big idea.
Sure. And then we get one of my favorite moment is you have, you know, Bryan's in the ring and they do sort of a close-up of his face and you just see sort of the exhaustion and somewhat of tears of him in the ring of the, you know, the realization of this great moment. And it's just you know, the whole thing is magical, but there's little moments within that where it's just like even more powerful. This was outstanding.
It was so outstanding. It has a very strong argument to be the best WrestleMania main event ever.
It's up in the top two or three for me, yeah. Having to rewatch them. And, I mean, it really is, it is quite exceptional.
Cause so many of them are politically based. Like, so it's really hard to look at the majority of WrestleMania main events and not see them as political decisions. But this one, especially more so than 20, about the same level as 10 of we're finally giving you, the fan who has been here forever, what we feel like you want.
Yeah. What you've told us you want very loudly.
Yeah. And have not shut up about for 30 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Every 10 years they give us what we want for a yeah. little while. For a little while. But
so weird, yeah. Right?
Yeah. For a few months, you get what you want, and then we're going to go back to what we want.
And so, I don't know, frankly, knowing that, and we know that, we've been around this whole time.
Yeah.
Knowing that, how anyone could have been surprised by what happened this year with WrestleMania 31. Like, of course they go with like their new Kevin Nash.
Yes.
Of course they do.
Yeah.
Of course they go with their good-looking tall guy who wears gloves.
Yeah.
Right?
And has long flowing hair. You know?
Of course they do.
Yeah.
Why would you think they would do anything else?
No. It's still just, well, I think the thing that I've been disappointed with, and granted, I haven't been watching much, so this is just sort of, correct me if I'm wrong on anything that I say, but I kind of think, like, it feels like he's very much become an afterthought in not a very particularly interesting story. Now, you know, he may perform really well in the match, and it may be the start of something better going on, but it just sort of feels like, particularly at the Royal Rumble, he just sort of felt like, you know, he was just sort of there, and no, like, when he lost, there was nothing that, you know, like, it wasn't made like a big deal that he lost, or that he was champion last year and he was losing this opportunity, or there was nothing involved in that. Now, they obviously, you know, they had him and Roman, you know, wrestle in the next main event, so they certainly did something with him afterward, but it just sort of feels like there's so much more they could do with him, not necessarily just even like putting him in a title match or, you know, pushing him as heavily as they did last year, but it just in terms of giving him something with a little bit of teeth to it.
Sure.
So that may be coming, but
yeah. I mentioned earlier that I have a theory about this.
Sure.
And so my theory about the issue with Daniel Bryan in like winter, spring 2015 WWE is that I don't think they thought he'd even be there.
Well, yeah.
And him being there, they had to make a decision. So, okay, we have Bryan now. We've also written pretty much everything up to and maybe after WrestleMania. Do we scrap it all just because Bryan's here, or do we keep everything going? And I think they decided to keep everything going. And what they've done is shoehorn Bryan in as kind of best they could without changing anybody else's stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and that's maybe why the Intercontinental Championship match is a 7-way instead of a 6-way. Like, 7 is an awkward number of people, right?
Yeah.
And the main event of Fastlane, like, who gives a shit? They would have figured that out 3 days beforehand,
right,
if Bryan wasn't around. I think the rumor for that, it was supposed to be a tag match or something like that. Like, it was the most throwaway of throwaway pay-per-views.
Yeah.
I think that's maybe the reason he hasn't been given much to do, and maybe he'll have a real story after the cycle of stuff that they'd written. I also wonder about his actual health or their confidence in his actual health.
Well, that's a fair point, you know, because obviously it was a serious neck injury that, you know, there was a lot of talk about it being possibly career-ending, so that there's
right.
not a great history of guys with those type of injuries, you know, having long careers, so.
And yeah. So I wonder if they have plans for him, but they want to protect him right now and let him heal up better.
Yeah.
So they put him in a lot of tag matches and a lot of multi-man matches where he doesn't actually have to do a whole lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean that's fair too. I just think that
I don't know that I don't know if it's a lack of confidence in him so much as, well, they had this plan already, mm-hmm. and they're not going to change the plan just because he's back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mel, we got this at least.
Yeah,
which is pretty good.
We did, and this is not bad.
Yeah,
we usually don't get WrestleMania 30 kind of stuff.
That's true. It is rare.
It is rare.
So we have to enjoy it.
We do. And it in this long soap opera that we call WWE professional wrestling, you have to sort of remind yourself that we are lucky to get good moments ever, because that's not the business model. Right? They throw them in.
Yeah.
But they don't throw them in to hook you. They don't throw you in so that you'll see the next show. They throw them in because they need them too, I think.
Yeah. Well, and they need to keep, you know, if they were always making a set, eventually we would give up, I would think. I mean, maybe not. Maybe we're just such...
I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, we need to be happy sometimes, or, you know.
Do we?
I would think so.
Because people who watch real soap operas don't ever get to be happy. And people who watch sports, like a Toronto Maple Leaf fan, he never gets to be happy.
Yeah, but they won championships like in the 60s probably, right?
Okay, so 100% of the living fans never got to see victory.
They win individual games, I guess.
I guess what I'm saying is, why do we even, like, we should be, like, professional wrestling, I feel the whole reason it's fake is so that sometimes we can get this.
Yeah.
Right? That's the reward for having to fake and choreograph and fix everything.
You get, everyone gets to be happy for a day.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's it.
That's fair.
Yeah.
So, Twitter questions?
Sure.
All right. Tony at TonyTimes2 asks if, do we think that the decision to give him one submission and one pin was the right way around? Should he have pinned Dave or Randy? I guess it's two different questions.
Yeah, you go first.
Well, I think probably the pin and then later the submission is probably the right way to go, just because I think the submission still means a little bit more than a pin, and so you save it for the final match. I did always kind of find it a little weird that he beat Batista instead of Orton. I mean, just because I figured that, like, he would beat Orton first, and then Batista would have the issue of, like, well, you didn't beat me, so I never have a one-on-one shot, and that would be a good way to do Batista versus Bryan, which I guess they considered but didn't end up doing. But I figured, well, when he beat Batista, it's like, oh, well, you haven't beaten Orton yet, so that gives them juice for one more match. And they, of course, they didn't do either. They went to Kane, but that was kind of what I was thinking. But I don't think it makes a big difference who he beat here.
They probably would have come back to if Bryan had kept if Bryan had stayed healthy, like the spring summer season would have looked very different.
Yes, but
you know?
true. So any other thoughts on that?
I like how they did it. I thought the pin was fine. I like that it kind of came out of nowhere and made Bryan look a little lucky. You know, I thought that was good. I thought you, like, don't entirely kill Triple H.
Sure.
But enough to be down for three, and then he's kind of back up again right away. That I believe that. I also believe Batista tapping out to stuff.
That's true.
Because he's smart. Because he's a bad guy, but he's smart. He has more brains than guts, which means he would tap out.
Yes. That is a perfect summation of him, I would say.
Yeah. I feel like Randy wouldn't. He'd be an idiot and pass out.
Yeah. We had a lot of questions about the furry boots, or to talk about the furry boots, and apparently Bryan originally bought them because he thought he would be in the Wyatt still, and then he sort of kept using them because he is frugal and it's for the, like, the environmental issue, I guess, you know. So that's cool.
Okay.
Yeah.
So is that why he's still wrestling in them?
I guess, like, you just, you know, it's like just like a thing. Well, I mean, why not? I guess there's no reason for him not to wear furry boots. I mean, you know, he's got the beard, so it kind of, you know, it fits that a little bit. Maybe he's just a big Berserker fan.
I sort of just looked at them as like the natural, like, how do you upgrade his outfit for a special night?
Sure.
I get it. And then I guess he keeps wearing it because a lot of people, when they blow some money on an expensive new outfit, like a Jericho or an Undertaker, well, that's just what they're wearing for the next little while.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like they don't necessarily have pay-per-view only outfits. Maybe that really separates the frugal from the non so frugal. Like Triple H, he doesn't bring out his, like, cape and helmet skull thing every time just because he plunks some money down.
Right.
Like, he might have charged that to the company.
It's possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Colm Kearns at Colm Kearn, C-A-I-R-N.
Oh,
C's. Yes. From a kayfabe standpoint, where do Bryan's two wins rank among the greatest one-night achievements performances?
Very, very high.
Yeah.
These weren't nobodies that he beat.
Right.
Like, like he beat the last 10 years of WWE's decisions.
That's a good way of putting it.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, the ones that I think about that compare to this are Bret Hart at King of the Ring.
Sure. Big.
Yeah.
That's big.
Because he beats Scott Hall, he beats Bam Bam Bigelow, and he beats Curt Hennig. Mm-hmm. And they're all three, you know, really good matches, particularly the Curt Hennig match. That's a great one. And then the title tournament at WrestleMania 4, Randy Savage winning, one of my favorite wrestling moments.
Sure.
But you got
to think like Savage's competition, you know, DiBiase certainly, but the other guys maybe not.
Well,
he beat
Greg Valentine in one man gang.
Greg Valentine was 160 years old at WrestleMania 4.
He was even older than Joe Louis at that point.
He got younger for a few years.
Yeah, right.
After that.
You know, he beat Butch Reed. I mean, none of those matches are particularly interesting. So,
take nothing away from Savage at WrestleMania 4, yeah. But it's not like he faced Evolution in one night.
That's true. Elizabeth's four outfits do, you know, add a little bit to the accomplishment.
Terrific.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
and of course, you know, Bret at 10, right?
Yeah, that's true.
He like by proxy beats Lex Luger and Mr. Perfect and Roddy Piper as well.
There you go.
You just throw them all in,
that
right?
That makes sense. Yeah.
Like he doesn't beat them in matches, but he beats their spirit in a way.
Sure.
Like that's why they had Roddy Piper as the ref, was because the last time we saw Roddy Piper on WWE TV, he was Bret's like enemy.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. That's a good point. I don't think I even thought about that before.
And Perfect, like everyone at WrestleMania 10 hated Bret Hart.
Yes. Well, that's the common theme.
everyone that was in matches that Bret was vaguely associated with didn't like Bret Hart anyway. Like Savage had no problem with him.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. But do you
like that? Do you like it when an entire show is built around one character, as opposed to like something like say WrestleMania 14, where it was a huge moment for Steve Austin and Shawn Michaels, but up until the 2 hour mark, the show kind of had not much to do with them.
Yeah, it depends on the moment or the character. I mean, I think there are great examples of it working, but there are also examples of it not working if I'm not particularly invested in the character or the story.
Can you think of an example of when it maybe just fell really flat for you?
Well, you know, I don't know if the whole show was built around it, but when I was thinking of sort of like this greatest one-night achievements is the Jericho Rock versus Austin thing, where he beat them both in the same night. But I always thought like that was just such, like, I get that he couldn't necessarily win clean, but like the way he won those matches was just like the worst, like, just like it was like the dumbest type of interference, and like it was basically everything was centered around Vince, and it was just like it was just poorly done. Like it was not done in a way that like did any favors for him at all, although he obviously by being able to say he was the first undisputed champion and being able to say he beat them both in one night, that's helped, you know, that boosts some esteem for him. But yeah, that one is an example of one where it doesn't work all that way. I'm trying to think of like a one night show where
honestly I think that was a pretty perfect example.
Yeah, there's probably King of the Ring where like somebody who I didn't care for won and, you know, would have been all over the show, and you know, that might not have worked so well for me. But
as a quick aside, I figured out how to fix the King of the Ring.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, if they ever want to do King of the Ring again, they just have to do it at Madison Square Garden, because they can't put a proper entrance ramp in Madison Square Garden. So the entrances they're forced to be really short.
Yeah. Well, I think Madison Square Garden is renovated to the point where they do the regular entrances there now.
Ah, God damn it.
Yeah. So we also have to have a time machine back to 1994. But
right.
Yeah.
I'm just fast entrances. That's the whole thing. You got to keep them brisk.
There you go.
Yeah.
I think basically you just need to not have a crown. You need to have something else. I think that's what it is. I think you need to have something that's not silly as a crown, because crowns work for a very small percentage of wrestlers.
Indeed.
Yeah.
It's tough to carry that around and get it through airport security.
Yeah, it is. That's a fair point. Yeah. I mean, you would think that being royalty, they would be exempt from such regulations, but apparently that's not the way it works.
Thanks, Obama.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, boy. So so our friend Adam at Space Crook is asking us to fantasy book the WWE landscape if Batista won the title. Do we?
Oh, my God.
I mean, I figure we probably just have Batista and Kane, which I'm sure would be exciting for everybody. So.
Batista versus Kane. Yeah. And then afterwards, it would be Batista versus Big Show.
Sure.
Obviously.
Yeah. Obviously,
that's
Batista
the next
versus
obvious.
Great Khali.
Great Khali's next.
Yeah.
In a rematch.
Sure. Batista and Triple H.
This whoever was like a wrestling fan in 2008 is really shuddering right now, because that's kind of what happened.
Yeah.
Batista versus Triple H. And then you'd get Batista versus like The Rock at SummerSlam.
Sure.
Like The Rock would come back.
Yeah.
Bobby Lashley. All of these matches would be like 35 minutes long.
Sure.
Too.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, they'd be wonderful. Guardians of the Galaxy would bomb.
Yeah.
Yeah. He'd be the greatest world champion of all time, obviously.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fun to think about. I also think about what they would do if how 2014 would have worked out if the day after WrestleMania, Daniel Bryan goes into like Triple H's office and he's like, "I want Brock's contract." I want to wrestle four times a year, and I'll be world heavyweight champion four times a year, and I'll defend it, and it'll be great, because it'll be worth a lot, and people will pay to see me, and it'll be awesome, and then I won't get injured.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, I don't think...
So instead, Brian gets injured, they spend 2 months stripping him of the title doesn't actually get defended until SummerSlam. Would it have killed them to just give Brian the spring off and have him defend the title at SummerSlam?
Well, I think
they make a huge deal about the fact that the champion has to defend every 30 days. So they go 150 days without a title getting defended because Brian gets injured.
I forgot about that.
John Cena wins the title, does one defense, and then goes to SummerSlam and loses it to Brock, who, yeah, I guess there was one match after that. But after that, he goes about 200 days without defending the title. I'm still angry about it.
Yeah, I don't know what to say.
That's my favorite what if, is if Brian just goes, just give me Brock's contract.
There you go. So he can just essentially fulfill his contract. Let's say his Nick was like a little bit better. So he, you know.
In fact, I don't know why more wrestlers aren't doing that.
Well,
I don't know why more wrestlers aren't going, can I have at least Jericho's contract? That guy seems pretty healthy.
I guess they like money more than they like time off.
Anyway.
our good friend Scott at Star of Savage wants us to sort of compare we pretty much already did this, comparing and contrasting the WrestleMania 10 title match setup with WrestleMania 30, and also talk about the set. You I feel like you're the man who talks about the set very well, so I'm going to let you handle that one.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
I mean, I really like WrestleMania 10 and 20 set, because I really like the, I guess, old-style Madison Square Garden setup of a short entrance and a really intimate-looking stage, right? Like, 10 and 20 really benefit from the crowd being 2 feet away from the wrestlers.
Sure.
WrestleMania 30 set is not my favorite one, not because it's not good, but because I don't feel like it really did anything different than the WrestleMania 27 set in Atlanta. Both of them are very similar setups. Like, they're both a giant WrestleMania logo atop what is essentially just a giant screen. And it's a very modern way of doing it. It's very visually impressive. But I liked what they did at 27 more with the giant screen, with the back and the sort of floor area. If you go back and you look at the entrances from 27, they do very creative things with wrestler videos at that show. And they didn't really do anything... They didn't really do anything interesting with the set at WrestleMania 30. It's very impressive and large, but it didn't really have a verb to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's my only real criticism of it. Otherwise, it's nice.
Yeah, it's nice. It's
I liked the ramp. I liked all the lights and stuff on the ramp. It was very cool. Noted lack of fireworks for a lot of guys at WrestleMania 30, though.
Yeah, I guess they were saving them for the end.
Like what? Like Batista doesn't get fireworks. That's like the whole reason people ever liked him for the, you know.
Yeah,
and he didn't get a spotlight. Like good guy Batista should get like the machine gun fireworks, and bad guy Batista should get that spotlight down the apron. And they didn't do either. It was a disappointing entrance.
Yeah, the entrances were a little bit lacking in the for the actual main event. I would agree. Yeah. There was a little bit of you know, they could have had a little bit more pageantry. Maybe not as much as Triple H, but at least like a little bit more than they ended up getting, you know.
This is what I'm saying about, like, just I think the crew is just tired at that point. Just like, can we just get this over with?
Yeah, just all get out of here, you know.
Yeah.
And then the last question by Joe Borges at Monkey Torture. Please don't actually be torturing monkeys.
Please don't.
I'm sure he's not. What should have been the first feud for Brian as champ?
6 months off.
Yeah.
But if you're not going to do that,
failing that.
Cause like, really, what do you do? You don't need to go to work the next day. You just did WrestleMania 30. Take some time off.
He was getting married that Friday anyway. So
I know. Give the guy a couple of weeks. Fuck. Like
I actually would have picked Sheamus. Cause he had like the previous issues with Sheamus. Like,
that would have been a fun couple of weeks. Yes. And it would have given Sheamus something to do. Cause Sheamus hasn't had one thing to do since WrestleMania 28.
Yeah. I think he had just come back a few months before that. He had been a good guy, but you know, wasn't really getting anywhere with that. They could have made him a bad guy, or they could have just like had him sort of like, you know, just remind Daniel Bryan of like his record against him at WrestleMania for
exactly.
Yeah. I mean,
would have been nice. That's a good idea. I like that.
Thanks.
Yeah.
That's all the Twitter questions.
Oh, cool. Okay.
You got anything else to anything else surrounding this or just Daniel Bryan or anything that you want to talk about beyond that?
Oh, I mean, not really. I think we were pretty thorough. I mean, I still really like Bryan. I still have no idea what kind of wrestler he is post injury. I've seen him wrestle and I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I'm not getting a sense of his style yet. He's like, if anything, he seems to be just kind of his signature moves now, but I've not really seen a real performance so far. And I wouldn't call the Fastlane main event a real performance because that was just him bouncing off Roman special moves,
sure.
Which are like that. I remember talking on the International Object podcast with Rich about how the only way Fastlane, like the only way that we become impressed with Roman enough that we accept him over Brian is if both of them do a very long and different kind of match. And they just kind of did a solid Raw main event. You know, I didn't really see anything special in that match.
Mm-hmm.
It was fine, but it wasn't like, come on. Like, again, we've been here a long time. We've seen special main events. We just talked about a very special main event.
Yes.
And like fast, like Reigns and Bryan was just it was just whatever. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe that'll be at WrestleMania with the 7-way championship. I think that'll just be a hot mess, to be honest with you. But I think look for what Bryan does after WrestleMania. That's going to be the real indication of whether WWE has faith in him or not.
Right. Or is still, you know, invested in him or, you know, is
exactly.
Cares
I
about
think
him.
If,
right.
If the months after WrestleMania, Bryan is still treading water and confusing people as to why he's not doing anything interesting, then maybe, yeah, they've lost faith in him.
Yeah. Well, you want to let everybody know about International Object. I imagine most of our listeners do know, but if there's anybody new who wants to know about what you do, why don't you let them know?
Well, I mean, I haven't really been doing much with it lately, but I have a sort of plan to change that. I have a couple of interesting things. But yeah, internationalobject.com will eventually soon be back up and running. But until then, the podcast is really the best place to get stuff. We're doing it monthly now, which is a new format. We'll be doing a new episode pretty soon. And just check that out. Find it on Mixcloud or iTunes or wherever you find podcasts. We're there.
Yeah. And yeah. It's always a good conversation between you and Rich. I always enjoy it. And
thanks. And then, of course, just INTL Object at Twitter.
Yes. You can find us at voicesofwrestling.com, and we're on iTunes at WrestleSpective as well. And, of course, Twitter at WrestleSpective are the best places to check us out. If you have any feedback on the show, I'm on Twitter and active on Twitter. So not as active as I used to be on Twitter, but I still am around and talking about stuff. So if you have anything to say to me, you can say it to my face on Twitter. So so thanks again for being on the program, sir. It's always excellent to speak to you about wrestling.
Yeah, you too, man. Always a pleasure.
And thanks, everyone, for checking us out. We're back with another episode, and hopefully we'll be on a little bit more of a regular schedule and be pumping out some episodes. You never know with me, but hopefully that is the case. So thanks, everyone, who has been listening and who has been saying nice things about the show and been wanting it to come back. Definitely appreciate the people really care about it. So that's a nice feeling. It makes me want to do more. So yeah, goodbye.